This is The View from Tab. I'm Jim Minnick.
I'm John Cruz.
And I'm Chris Palmer.
And we may be getting Mr. Beats joining us shortly, but we haven't seen him yet. He is missing in action. We know he had an appointment, so we were going to start early because of this. Not that anybody listening to this knows when we're starting. But anyhow, we're hoping the Beats shows up. And what we were talking about last time was very, very deep into the tabbing process. And I've had some emails since then and some discussion on my blog and various places. And I know, John, you've had some of this stuff too.
Sure.
But where we had left this was the idea that it made some sense because of the distribution of AFNAG. And as I say, this is a real thing. This is not something we've made up. I've seen enough statistical data to convince me that this is true. As you get to evenly matched debaters and stronger debaters, the negative does have a decided advantage for whatever reasons. And, you know, we could talk about changing what those reasons might be. But one of the things we can at least do is mechanically address it in a tab room, perhaps, so that it's minimized or equalized. And, you know, so you always have the 50% of rounds, which of course you're going to do anyhow in an even number tournament, you know, even number of rounds of tournaments. But what we had said was that, okay, so you have two random rounds. That's fine. Nobody has any objection to random rounds. And then you have a bracketed round. And the idea was that for that bracketed round, you would have, you know, you're going to go AF or NEG. Now, instead of doing the next round as a new bracket, you know, from 3-0s down to 0-3s, have it be in the same bracket. So we would create a bracket that would go twice. So essentially you're dealing in that same area. And I don't know if we explored that in enough depth to say it was a good idea or a bad idea. I know that there were some issues about, I mean, it would be, you know, theoretically it's lag pairing, you know, which some people have, you know, objections to. But, you know, I mean, that's what I would like. I mean, is this a good idea to take that and just do the third and fourth round and make that one bracket and maybe do the same thing with the fourth, I mean, with the fifth and sixth round and have them be one bracket rather than always working towards isolating the strongest people and therefore always moving quicker towards that thing where the negative is always going to win. I mean, so that's the question. Now, Chris, you weren't with us last time. I don't know if you listened to what we talked about. But I know, you know, I've written about it. What are your thoughts on this? Do you think this actually works out?
Well, I don't know. I think in general, I'm kind of suspicious of tab manipulations to try to get around the AFNEG problem, because I view them as sort of trying to put curtains on a bad situation and pretend it's not there. You know? So yeah. I feel like we're fixing the wrong problem if you start mucking around with the tab room such that, you know, you're guaranteeing people be AF and NEG within the same bracket. You know, at that point, you lead to all sorts of problems. What do you do? Have two final rounds?
I mean, I sort of agree with that. I think all of this is different from, like, side equalization, which was the thing I was talking about last time, because I don't know. I just feel I have philosophical reasons to think side objection is good beyond the AFNEG problem. I just have never, as I said last time, maybe it's because I grew up in a world where I didn't go to that many tournaments that had elims. They were all like multiple, you know, multiple round tournaments that didn't break into anything. But to this day, I don't understand why we flip for sides and outrounds. I just don't understand it because it's a switch side debate. Like, it just has literally never made sense to me. I mean, I accept it because that's what it is, right? But I feel like we sort of take that for granted and don't really explore what the deal is with that, why we suddenly abandon the format that we have in the most important rounds of all. So while I think that side equalization helps solve, well, not solve, but helps put a Band-Aid on the AFNEG problem, I feel comfortable with its existence outside of that problem. Whereas something with lag pairing and things like that, then I start to feel more uncomfortable.
Well, what, I mean, forget down the third and fourth round. What about if it's the fifth and sixth round? Because at this point, we're only talking about a handful of people, you know, that are going to be in that undefeated or down one bracket. And so it's addressing a smaller universe, but theoretically, it's really going to be true that whoever is going to go neg is going to win those rounds.
Well, except when you have the situation where some poor kid goes 4-0 and then gets clobbered out of elimination because they have to hit two undefeateds in a row rather than just one.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you get a 4-0 with a kid who's low speaks, and then they go into rounds 5 and 6.
Yeah, that's a good point, yeah.
You know, they drop the two top kids in the tournament, say, or something like that, then a kid who probably deserved a break gets pushed out.
Mm.
You know, so...
Yeah, that does have that effect. That effect is, I hadn't even thought about that, but that effect is definitely there. You can really get clobbered, you know, you're the low person in this.
The same thing even more so can happen if you're doing it in the earlier power match rounds. Like some kid could go 2-0 and be pretty lucky at having done so. I mean, how many 2-0s out there are the second worst debater happened to draw the worst debater and then their first round opponent didn't show up? So all of a sudden you get this second worst debater in the field who through pure luck boxing is 2-0. And then they draw last year's TOC champion. And then they get last year's TOC runner-up or whatever, you know. Like,
well, they sort of deserve it. I mean, there is a karmic reality to that.
I suppose that's true, but that child's never going to debate again after those two rounds.
Well, he could have gotten him in the random. So look at it that way. Okay, but John is.
But the randoms are randoms. I mean, we're being cute, but that's a point that I feel should be emphasized, right?
I don't know.
I think we're taking
the structure of a fairly tabbed tournament and then trying to make it somehow unfair to redress
but
a different...
But I question how fair the tabbing is. I mean, a lot of it is just we do what we do because we do. But one of the things everybody says is we're protecting the better debaters. So all of...
How?
By having the high person always eat the low person. In any bracket, the high hits the low. So we're always protecting the higher debater by whatever criterion we put that person in. And why do we do that?
But we'd be doing that anyway if we black paired with them.
I know, exactly. But why? I mean, so. But I really question this, and maybe it's just stupid on my part. But I really don't know why we do this. Why do we favor the higher seed so much that we put them absolutely? You know, so if we have 30 people, and you're going to have that TOC person who has 230s against some poor schmuck who just accidentally got to be there with 226s, and he's going to cream them. Yeah, so it's almost a guarantee.
But if you look at it this way and say that the TOC person's going to cream whoever they hit, let's just say that there's one kid who's just way better than everybody else, right?
Yeah.
Shouldn't they get rid of the kid who is least likely to break anybody?
But why should I design the tournament so that kid has the easiest competition?
On an unrelated note, Mike,
what's the purpose of the tournament?
What was that?
What's the purpose?
Sorry, but go back to Chris.
Well, that goes back to the question, what's the purpose of a tournament? I mean, is the tournament designed to produce the winner who is the best debater? Or is a tournament designed for some other means? And if the tournament is designed to produce the winner being the best debater that weekend, then yes, the crappy kid should get creamed, right?
So in other words, that helps me understand this. So we're making it so that if in fact, we're making it so that if you are the best debater, nothing should prevent you. There's nothing mechanical that should prevent you from winning this tournament, provided you do the best debating. Okay, that logic helps me because I'm thinking, by taking the top person and the bottom person, I am, doing my best to make that happen. And as the brackets narrow, I would maintain that it becomes less and less true. You know, so by the time I get
less
to
less of an advantage.
Yeah,
if you're 5-0-5-0 round, A, you're both breaking, but B,
it's
going to be tight,
tough round. Yeah.
Yeah. Unless it's a crappy tournament, the best 5-0 and the worst 5-0 are not too far apart. So.
Yeah. So it's really just in those. So it really makes sure that we get to the later rounds. And then when we have those later rounds, they're going to be tough. And the right people are in the best debaters are. They haven't had some. They're going to be there no matter what, I guess. You know, so,
well, not necessarily. Not all.
If they were hitting each other. That explains why you don't do high highs. Because if they're hitting each other early on. Was that Beats? I'm going to just bring Beats into this. If I can. I'm looking in the wrong program. Always a problem. Okay.
Oh, that's awkward.
Yeah, so. Let's see. So I'm doing this. Those of you who are listening at home, I'm clicking buttons right now, and this is going to bring Mr.
You
Beach into us.
Presumably, cut this part out. Yes.
Yeah, if I were going to spend the time.
The live commentary.
The live commentary, yes.
Live commentary and technical failures.
As it happens.
Yeah, and there's Mr. Beach.
All right, Beats. He is here.
Is he?
Wow. Or is he?
I heard him.
Ah, there he is.
Ah.
Okay. We're recording, Beats, so don't say anything humiliating.
He's dumbstruck.
Beats is coming in live from via satellite. There seems to be like a delay on his responses. What's going on here?
Mike, say something.
He's quiet.
Hello.
We hear you.
Okay, we do hear you.
Okay. Is it okay?
Yeah, yep. You're on. You're on now. It's working. Okay. We just explained why we're. What was that?
That was Chris Palmer.
Finished.
Chris Palmer. Okay, Chris Palmer just disappeared because he wants to get his dinner, and he disappeared in the worst way.
Okay. Anyway. All right. This is awkward.
No, this is the fun technical part. We lost him. He didn't get his dinner. He just disappeared all by himself. So anyway, we were talking about why we protect the high seeds, and the point being that we're going to have. I love all this ringing. We're going to have a tournament where we want the person to win who is the bet who does the best debating. So we don't want to throw any artificial obstacles into that person's way. So that's where we had brought the conversation to this
about
point.
It's about lag
and lag pairing.
Yeah, lag pairing. Well, I was just asking the basic question: why do we do a tournament so that the high seed is advantaged? I mean, because we're going to pick the high seed. Like a 3-0 is going to hit an 0-3 and almost guaranteed. You know, the highest 3-0 is going to hit the lowest 3-0, and you know, guaranteed to to win that round. Very unlikely to lose that round. And we're building a tournament to do
actually.
That.
I think
but it's not going to be because the 3-0, the high 3-0 was not the best debater, because the high 3-0 was somebody who snuck through and got some really lucky speaks on the first.
I wonder next year as we're tabbing, we should probably just sort of like make a point to check and see what's the lowest seeded 0-2 or 2-0 or 3-0 to upset the top seed or something like that.
It'd be fun to watch how that progresses, because we're saying this sort of instinctively, making assumptions that are logical assumptions that may not be true.
Absence of data, right?
Okay, but why?
It depends what you mean by the highest seed. I mean, the highest seed is determined by us, and so we're not really protecting the debater that's debating the best necessarily. And especially early in the tournament, it's completely artificial. I mean, speaker points after two rounds is an almost meaningless
thing. I'm not sure about that. I mean,
those could be the two that get dropped.
Typically those two get dropped. I mean, because I don't know any tournament that changes how they're pairing after the first how they pair round, like how the tiebreakers, if I don't know
change
if they right. change the tiebreakers as the tournament's going on. And so if you've chosen drop high lows, which most tournaments do, that number is going to be zero after the first two rounds. So it's truly meaningless to use speaker points in the first two. Well, I guess then it goes to total. If you use total as the next one, I guess some do judge variance or op wins, but I shouldn't say it's meaningless. I should say it's random. If those are the two things that you're doing, and I don't know if a better word to describe the person that's the top seed at that point. Is it the person who is debating the best after two rounds? Is it the person who has had who beat the other people who are debating the best after those two rounds? Or if it should be the person who has wowed two judges the most after two rounds. I don't know what the determinant is after wins.
I did like the idea which we talked about last week, which is making op wins at this point really count and putting them right at the top. I mean, obviously wins first, but then op wins for the next couple of pairings for the third round and the fourth round, because that does seem to speak more than the very, very random two judges that you could have get, who, as we say, could have been the, could be the ones who get dropped in a double high low. But you know, you're, you know, if you hit somebody and
or
they
just
had
a high low.
Yeah, and yeah, in the high low, and if yeah, and if you hit people who had serious competition versus people who have very easy competition, that has the objective, yeah. You know, well, they had easy competition because these people won and these people didn't win. I mean, this is one of the things where all of the writing that I've seen, and certainly what I've been pushing for establishing speaker points, is based now not on you know, criteria like you know, they said seven things or they answered the stuff well, but this person ought to win the tournament, this person ought to break, this person might break, this person should never break, this person should quit debate, you know. So using that kind of criteria to establish yeah, you know, so you're measuring against the reality of where they are in this field. So you're saying your speaker points are putting them somewhere in the field, which is what Op Wins does. Op Wins does it, of course, absolutely objectively, not perfectly, because you only have a couple of rounds, but yeah, better, I think, than the speaks. And the idea of changing the settings in TRPC as you go along, because this is a more meaningful setting now, and this will be a more meaningful setting later, I don't think that is objectionable, if in fact we think those settings are the good settings to have.
Yeah, but, I don't think. Oh, go ahead.
But what? I'm curious. What is broken about what we're doing now exactly? In that regard,
I don't know if anything's broken so much as like I mentioned last. I just it's just it's tweaking and thinking.
Yeah.
Adding aftermarket parts to a really nice car.
Right. Yeah, right. This is the kind of thing we do so much tabbing, but and a lot of it we do by rote, and we're very. I agree with you. We're very happy with. I think we're happy with what we do, and the way it gets done. But you're doing it if you can fix it. You know,
there's a danger though inherent in that. In that right now the debate community is such that I can go, if I were to get on a plane and fly to Beats' Harvard Westlake tournament, which is about as far as I could possibly take my team and still get a debate tournament. One end of the country to the other, I'm going to know what that's like. Like, I'm going to know the drill. I'm going to know how it's run. I'm going to be able to explain to my kids how round one, round two, round three, round four works. You know, it's going to be familiar. Well, and if you start, you know, if you open Pandora's box, that may not be true anymore. And it isn't true in the speech world. You know, the debate tournament that Beats runs and the debate tournament we run at Lexington are pretty much the same beast. Modulo who comes. But the speech tournaments in his area and the speech tournaments in my area, I can guarantee, are dramatically different beasts.
Really? I was not aware.
Very much so. Like, the way they do it in Texas is not the way they do it in Massachusetts, is not the way they do it in Minnesota. And the only, and then you go to nationals and there's this weird convergence where it's not the way anybody does it. And, you know, there's sort of this vague confusion and dissatisfaction that derives from that, because, you know, nobody's really comfortable with how it goes because nobody's very familiar with how it goes. And
well,
so
is that partially
solved
by publishing tournament procedure?
Publishes tournament procedure, and you still get asked the same question. Like, I get asked these same tabbing questions year after year after year at Yale, and I can predict which regions are going to ask which questions because, you know, it will be the diff between Yale and Florida, and therefore all the Florida coaches will – the same coaches will ask this year after year after year. And it just, you know, it leads to a lot of confusion, and it also tends to make it harder to have a true circuit.
I don't mind that tournaments. I mean, I don't. I guess for one, I don't think that that confusion is even solved by everyone following standard practices, because I think every single tournament we always talk about the person that comes up and says, well, they told me, or I heard, or whatever. The confusion exists regardless. I think it should be
normal tournament procedure. But that mostly comes from kids, doesn't it? Doesn't that come from kids, mostly, not coaches?
I'm not positive that's the case.
I don't know. It seems to me that it's mostly the kids themselves, and the usual answer is go talk to your coach. He'll explain it to you. So if said coach exists. Yeah.
I have no problem specifying in round three we will power this way for this rationale and just posting it and just saying, and just put it on the wall outside the tavern or put it in the packet or even on the pairing, say this round was powered like this. I have no objection to just putting that up there.
But we do go to tournaments that have very specifically unique ways of doing things. I mean, Apple Valley has their thing where they go by op wins, right? They don't go by speaker points in their pairings. What we did at NDCA was that thing where it's speaker points mixed in with something else.
It's like the NBA rules, which means necessarily that NBA had its own way of doing things.
Yeah. So there's we do have some places we go that do things differently for whatever reason. And, you know, they're close enough to the norm that they're accepted by people. And everybody knows that they're there, or anybody who's paying attention knows that those are the way of doing things. And it works. I mean, you can object to it or not object to it, but you know it's going on, and it doesn't cause any confusion or anything that I know of.
Oh, it causes confusion, I'm sure.
But
I think I'm talking as somebody who runs tab at a very large college tournament, and the first thing that pops into my head as soon as there's an inconsistent way of running debate is that is 15 more conversations I have to have every year at Yale with the same people over and over again. And that is many more times that I have to sit there in a hallway and have this extended philosophical conversation that I do not have time for in the middle of my tournament. You know, why did we pick op wins and not speaker points? And why is it done this and not that way? And, you know, debate coaches tend to have very little sense of there's a busy person in front of me who really doesn't want to have this conversation with me. And they'll just keep talking, especially if anything's thrown at them that closely resembles a curveball. And so I guess as a tournament director, what I try to do is minimize the number of curveballs I throw at people, because no matter how many times you post it, no matter how many times you warn people that it's coming, there's always, it only takes that one person who decides that, you know, round four is a great time to have this conversation with the tournament director, and they're stuck in the hallway. You know what I mean? And that's just happened to me too many times. And so perhaps that's not the thing to optimize for, but that's my reaction.
Yeah. I'm sure that those conversations are had to when the decision was made to publicize the records of every kid or to, right. Like those.
It helped that we did that all at once. You know, what was helpful about that is we just did it for all the tournaments, and so it only took twice, and everybody was used to it. So,
I think I think that there's a lot more variance in how tournaments choose to power their rounds than we might think. Because at every tournament I ask that I'm tabbing, I say, how do we want to have this set up? And it's not always the same. I mean, Op wins moves back and forth like an abacus. I mean,
it's one of those things where, like, how you're going to know? I mean, no one's going to go up there and total up all of the results posted so far and figure it out backwards, right? So,
it does print out, though. Yeah. I mean, it gives you the information. I mean, I certainly go through the same thing. I ask.
I think it's something nobody talks about. Maybe, right. Maybe nobody really thinks about it that much right now. It's possible. Yeah.
But one other thing, if there's any action point out of what we have been saying, is why wouldn't we want to do the side equalization in the break rounds?
Well, I don't think it's my theory on this, and this is sort of a theory of history, why we ended up doing flips and elims. I was thinking about this, and I've been thinking about this sort of in the back of my head a lot lately, is I get the sense that the way our tournaments have grown, the original debate tournament was probably just prelims, right? And then at some point, somebody had the great idea, why don't we have a final round? And why don't we take the top two teams and have them debate each other? And then everybody can watch, and won't that be lovely? And, oh, okay. All right, fine. And it was sort of an exhibition, and it just kind of grew that way. And then somebody was like, wow, well, you know, it's a big tournament, so let's have a semifinal, and so on and so forth. So I would imagine that the original elimination round or rounds were viewed more in the lines of like a special extra bonus at some tournaments than they were really an ordinary thing. And what I base this on is actually the evolution of the public forum divisions at the Massachusetts Forensic League tournaments, the local tournaments, is exactly that. You know, we began by giving four prelim rounds and that was it. And then some tournaments added a final if there was extra time. You know, and now some of them will actually run five single-flighted prelims, a semi and a final all in one day, which is really incredible when you think about it.
That's a lot of debating.
That's a lot of debate for $5.
But, yeah, pretty good deal.
It is. And so, yeah, and they do a very good job. And if you've got the extra rooms, you know, PF fits in rooms that speech rounds don't. So, you can sort of see that same progression. And when your final round is just sort of an extra little bonus, there's no problem having a flip. But if you then draw that out over the course of 30, 40, 50 years to an extra little bonus final round to double octa finals, you know, maybe the original logic starts to fall apart. But on the flip side of that, and the reason I was thinking about it, is I'm kind of wondering, and I'm sort of incredulous, actually, that we spend about half our tournament hours not allowing most of our students to debate through the mechanism of elimination rounds. And so when I said earlier that if your purpose of your tournament is to make sure the winner of your tournament is the best debater or the person who happens to do the best debating that weekend, I wonder if that's really what we should be optimizing for. You know, you go to a tournament, you get there on Friday, you debate a couple rounds, and then, you know, the vast majority of the kids are done by the middle of the day on Saturday. And then then the rest is a like 7-hour exercise and just getting rid of people.
Well, that's not really true. I mean, I'm going to have, you know, you're going to do the same thing. You're going to have your team watch some rounds. You know, so the first couple of rounds, you're going to say, well, go watch so-and-so because they're, you know, a good debater and you'll learn something from them.
Right.
And you do that a couple of times. And then pretty much everybody just goes home unless they're still in it. So I don't think it's really.
But how is that or worse than having shorter tournaments that have 8 prelims for everybody and then a semi and a final?
I think that first off, debate is not, this is not a unique issue to debate because most tournaments do have some kind of an elimination process.
Yes.
Now, what some tournaments do is that they could do what like Intel does, which is like you have a tournament for everyone and then you come back another time for, that's what a lot of people I discover who don't know much about debate think debate is. When they hear you made it to the semifinals, they assume that's a separate tournament or something like that.
Right.
I occasionally find that that's what people think.
Yeah, but that's how Drama Guild and things like that.
Right, yeah. That's how Intel works. That's how a lot of different things work. But I actually think that your point here is really good. But I don't know that that means that we have to change. I think that that's a more community-oriented thing. I mean, Newark actually
talks about it. I think it would be good as an option.
Yes, I don't disagree with that at all, actually.
Like, all our tournaments sort of look the same, and what they look like is most of the kids shut up at 1 o'clock.
It would be cool to have novice and JV tournaments that are just 8 rounds, and everyone, you know, then you just rank the kids at the end. Actually, Newark talked about doing that with their tournament policy division, and it just didn't pan out in the end. Actually, what they did was do 5 prelims and then break a random number of people to what I guess were like exhibition things, and that I didn't really like because I felt that was,
I can do that, but I have like my novice divisions
novice,
and things like that.
Novice
and
would be excellent.
I mean,
there's definitely something to be said about just having an 8-round.
Yeah, and whenever we've talked about it and we've had to make some decisions, we've always sort of felt that you know, having the most rounds for the most people, given the option, is better than a break. You know, breaking to whatever, you know, you want more people debating than fewer people debating, you know. So, you know, there's a great logic to that. Because, I mean, I do this, you know, my novices, and I'm breaking to, God knows, have partial doubles or some nonsense like that, where I just have another round or two, whatever it is, and have them break further down. But they all get a lot more debating, and they're all novices, so what do they care? And they get a lot of debate out of it, which is the whole point.
It depends on what the purpose of, of the term. I mean, Andy Sherrier, a friend of mine, and some of you guys know, coach at Lakeville South, you know, way back, I don't want to say way back, but like maybe in the late 90s, early 2000s, said, we don't have to crown a state champion every single weekend. We don't have to do two-day tournaments that are seven rounds or six rounds, break to quarters or octaves, and make it last forever. And it's not because of what Andy's comments were, but I think that people were feeling that in Minnesota, that every weekend you had to give up 2 days, and you had to, and like Chris is saying, like half the tournament, you're there for one or two kids on your team at most, or just finishing your judging obligation because you don't even still have kids in. And so Minnesota, I think, started suffering from the opposite effect now, where you cannot go to a two-day tournament. None exist, I think, in September. The first one is at the end of October, and I think there are a total of two or maybe three two-day tournaments left in Minnesota. All that's left now are Friday afternoon tournaments with no elims or Saturday tournaments with no elims. And they've gone sort of the opposite direction, where there's no more elimination tournaments for kids to go and get a high caliber tournament outside of Blake in the Minneapolis or whatever. They have to leave because I know I was talking to Shane Stafford, and he was begging the community to say, let's try to get together and have a two-day tournament with elims so that some of my kids can experience that. And but those have all sort of gone away now, and there aren't many left, and it's all one day, 5-6 elims or prelims, no elims of tournaments.
Well, and certainly Minnesota, going the opposite
Minnesota debate too isn't as strong as it used to be. I mean, there used to be a lot of very strong debaters coming out of Minnesota, and that seems to have dropped off. So
I don't know what that is a reason.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of factors behind that. Regions kind of.
That's true. I have a very much a test tube tournament as far as the novices are concerned, because it's literally the first time novices have a 2 day tournament.
Right.
In our region. Yeah, so we can play around with that one.
I was outright disappointed, and I don't mind going on record saying that, when Newark said they were going to do that in policy and then didn't do it. I think eight round.
I sort of missed that.
Bel Air in Texas and Houston does a famous thing in their area with the eight round. It was like a novice roundup kind of thing, and the idea is to maximize the number of debates for everyone. I think that's Six. Great. I mean, I agree with Beats that it should really be about balancing out. Mm-hmm. What different tournaments need to be and stuff like that.
Right. But you don't want to go too far.
But if I'm having novices, it's just give me as many rounds as I can for these new kids, right? Well, and there's nothing else that matters.
It also means my novices are nicely exhausted for the 4-hour bus ride back home.
So wear them out, Which I can have them run around the track too. But
I should make them do laps. That's
okay.
A good
we got
to.
That is something I would definitely think about and probably do something about. Yeah, because I think there's really, I mean, I can't come up with any reason why I should be isolating a handful of novices as much as giving all of them as many rounds as I can and as much.
And I mean,
experience.
If you want to give awards in the end, you just rank.
Well, give some awards. I mean, and maybe we'll have we'll talk about it. Offline.
Give the award to the person still standing.
Yeah.
So. Still alive.
Yeah, but you can really. I mean, you can. You don't have rounds to have a final. Seven awards. You can just give out. First through 10th place, like you would at
a
NHL.
That's
there absolutely is. There's no reason to have, like Andy Sherrier said, to crown the national champion every single weekend.
Yeah.
Well, the other thing, too, is once you have those, once you get into elims everywhere else, you could start single flighting some of those rounds because your varsity debaters have been knocked out and you have a lot of extra rooms, so you could really start moving, too.
Yeah.
I mean, at the Whitman tournament, I think, we were sort of on the fly just adding prelim rounds when we
That's
were
right,
like,
we did.
When we were like, because we were going to do six and then break to some sort of partial octaves, and then we were like, let's just, and then we ended up doing eight rounds and then breaking to semifinals or partial quarterfinals or something.
Quarters. Like we broke to a full quarter.
Yeah. A full quarter. Okay. Mm-hmm. But we just decided, these people are here to debate. They paid a lot of money to come here, and so
That was perfect for that situation because you had this, like all these TOC level debaters, fairly close to TOC coming up, so they got to really go to town with each other, and so having the most rounds made sense there. I mean, yeah, so a lot of it is what makes sense, like we've been saying, what makes sense for the tournament that we're going to. Yeah, so I'm thinking, like, you know, talk about this. Okay, we're not going to crown a champion, but like a tournament like the Bronx, which is really, you are, that is in fact the goal there. You wouldn't want to change the goal at a tournament like that, because the goal is really, yeah, here's a national tournament, a lot of people, blah blah blah. So we really do want to, yeah. And there's a bunch of tournaments that are just like that, but especially with the other divisions, you know, like novice divisions and stuff like that, where. Yeah, you're, for all you know, these people aren't going to even be in the activity 2 months from now. So, you know, giving them experience. I mean, this is the biggest problem.
There is a place to have elims, and you want to have that before your state title or your whatever for the novices. But
the first tournament of the year.
I agree. Yeah. I mean, like I said, I don't mean to beat a dead horse, but I really thought that this was such a good idea for that Newark proposed, and it was really disappointing in the end that they didn't do it. So I think that that's fantastic.
I think that's what Notre Dame does. Our first tournament in California, Christina Tlongan just runs a novice tournament, and it's just, I think it's 1 day, 6 rounds, just that's it. And she gives awards to the kids that go undefeated and get one loss.
It was sort of like an MHO. We only have 4 rounds. We just bring it up from 3 to 4. And, you know, we try to give as many awards as we can to people who did well. And, you know, it's getting at that point, that tournament, those tournaments, there's one a month. They exist so the kids get rounds. I mean, so that they get the opportunity to debate. I mean, so, you know, what is the function of your tournament? And even in that tournament, what is the function of a given division? No, the functions of novice divisions may not necessarily, but later in the year, if I have a novice division, let's say at Lexington. Yeah, so Lexington season's like 2/3 over or something. I don't think I'm operating under the same principle as I was when at Bump, you know, three months earlier. And I would probably want to have, you know, I wouldn't want to change the structure of break rounds, you know.
Well, it becomes harder, too, because we have the policy tournament starting. And
but even that removed, I mean, a lot of it's just, why am I going to a tournament that by then I've sort of figured out who my novices are, how they're doing, who I want to, like, drag along and convince to come and so forth and so on. Yeah, so it's a different thing. Whereas at the Bump first tournament, you know, you got the great unwashed. You have no idea yet, and you just want
sometimes
to bring them
literally.
Well, maybe your kids, you know. But, yeah, so you know, there are different principles. Which, as we've been saying this, I'm thinking back to something we had talked about a long time ago, and I just want to remind Chris, you especially, about this, which is we talked about.
Thank you.
We had talked about go-betweens that would be that we would have at the tournaments, and I've always thought this was a great idea. We really haven't done anything about it, but a place like Yale is a really good place to have somebody, you know, because we had talked about, you know, issues where, you know, if I'm in the tab room. I'm tabbing. I don't have time to address certain issues that might come up.
So and you don't have basically foist, you know, all those difficult coaches off on somebody else.
Yeah. So exactly. But I mean, we had to. I mean, you know, it was also a harassment thing or problems or something where somebody could go, and there was actually somebody who was paid, so to speak, to listen to them, or that would actually be able to act, who had no horse in the race, so to speak. And I think, I mean, I think this is something we had all agreed was a good idea, to have an ombudsman, and we should do it. I mean,
it's a matter of just doing it, and that's probably
not to play analyst here, but I don't really see what the connection was between those two things. Where, how did you just leap?
Oh, well,
it was just actions we could take. I mean, we've been talking all year about this and that, and so, I mean, it's one thing to talk, excuse me.
Well, it's not a bad idea to introduce that coinciding with a radical change, because then that gives you an outlet by which to capture the feedback of the radical change, right?
But the only radical change I'm thinking, I mean, is not flipping coins in the break rounds.
Oh, okay, so we're back to that.
We're back to why you never really made your you didn't argue again. You didn't give me a good argument why
there
it was
are
a bad
no
idea.
Arguments against it. That's why.
No
arguments against it, except that it's what we all do. And I think tournaments are well within the right to have coin flips and outrounds if that's what they want to do. But nobody thinks about this critically.
I have a question. Sure. All right. More than an argument. All right. You go into the octafinal round, right? Mm-hmm. Seven affirmatives win. What do you do?
Then there is a random.
Yeah, there will be coin flips
But the coin flip doesn't determine which side you want to debate. The idea, as I understand it from how it's done in college debate, is you flip a coin, and then if it's heads, the higher seed affirms. If it's tails, the lower seed affirms.
Or whatever, you know, just say if it's this, you get.
Okay, but what's the difference between that and what we do now?
Someone that
you're removing the choice from it.
But everybody picks negative anyway, so what's the difference?
Well, that's not. I don't know.
the coin flip still has a winner and a loser, right?
But not if it's predetermined. I mean, if there really isn't a coin flip, because then the high seed goes F.
No, the winner is always, you know, the winner is the kid who gets to go negative.
Well,
right.
There is no winner or loser in that coin flip.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there is. The kid who gets to go negative. Well. I mean, the problem is that AFs can't win Elim rounds.
But then adding the choice factor doesn't help.
Right, I think taking it away
doesn't help either, though, because the choice factor now, the kid who wins the coin flip goes negative and then wins the debate, probably.
Insofar as the net advantage being that resembles the tournament better in that in round three we don't flip a coin and let people choose. The computer flips the coin
that's ultimately the point that I'm trying to get at. Because I've said from the start about this that I do think it's sort of a band-aid solution in some ways, and it kind of addresses the thing. Although, as you're right, I mean, you're right, Chris, that it doesn't remove the statistical likelihood that the negative is going to win. I just think that it makes more sense from a consistency purpose that you don't flip coins in it. I just never understood.
I can get behind that, certainly. And the other thing it removes is that you get those kids who refuse to flip the coin until the second before the AC begins.
Right.
And that tends to lead to worse debate. But I don't see that as related to the issue that affirmatives have a hard time winning. I agree.
Yeah. No. These are two different things, but this is something that at least handles it. It doesn't fix anything, but it does even it out.
It only attempts to fix it in the instance where a kid can go straight through Elims,
right,
never having to affirm.
But that could still happen.
Yes, it could.
Still happen, but it's not.
Yes, but it would be way less likely.
Mm-hmm. So you would break the bracket to prevent.
No, it doesn't break the bracket.
I mean, it's just naturally going to make the assignment or do the flipping for them.
But in
the instance where their opponent has to affirm, their opponent is due negative, they would be forced to have to affirm then.
I mean, there is. It's not like 100% of all, 100% of the AFs win. I mean, lose. No. It's there is a breakdown, and there still is. We have seen 100%, and we have seen all the quarters rounds.
But here's the scenario that I think would happen. I think your kid, a strong AF, your one seed, your two seed, your three seed at going AF is going to be able to beat. The 64 seed or 32 seed, depending on what a tournament breaks to, right?
Mm-hmm. Usually, yeah,
and so
sure.
Those kids who, by luck and dint of the draw, get to go AF and doubles and octos will be your tournament winners.
Why would that be the case?
Because they will have two AFs in the bank, and that will make them.
No. There's no banking. I don't think that there's banking.
Well, then
involved.
Why do you?
I think there is. No,
it's based. If you're negative in round two, let's say you're negative in the octas due to flip because you've done even number of draw negative in the doubles, and then you get the flip negative in the octas in the quarterfinal round. If your opponent is did the same thing, It's just going to be a random draw. Right?
Yeah, but
if your opponent did the same thing.
But if your opponent, let's say your opponent did 1-1, then what is it? Then it's.
Well, then the fair thing would be to do that. You go negative, and the opponent goes affirmative, right? But you're then
the fair thing would be to even it out. would be to try to even it out.
Right, that's what I meant. So you, by going two AF rounds when the disparity between you and the opponent is much greater, you're banking AFs and therefore earning the right to go negative later, which is strategically valuable. And so you introduce this fact. Well, it's true.
I think they activate this.
If I were programming it would do that.
I want to hear what Beats is saying.
Go ahead.
There is data on this in the Parley League, APTA, in the East Coast. They do concern themselves with sidelock a lot because it's perceived that the negative there has an advantage as well, I believe, especially in the later rounds, in the final round. And so teams will go through great paroxysms to attempt to be through flips. I guess they do a flip unless it's locked, unless there's a reason not to. And teams will have a very strong advantage if they're due to be op in the final round. And op has won like final rounds going back and back. And because of that, they actually, you know, they very much want to be affirmative early in the Elim rounds and sort of bank a few of those. And that gives them a strong advantage. So those early flips tend to be determinant of which of the strong teams are going to win it.
But if you don't have a flip at all, where are you getting the opportunity to bank these? Like, where are you getting this?
Well, then it's the same thing, but it's just pure luck.
Yeah, it's luck. It's
That seems to be better. What I'm saying is you're just introducing a source of randomness into
it's a different sort, but there's less randomness overall.
Well, I think that you're shifting with a percentage of less.
But here's the overall, there are stories upon stories
of people getting to affirm or negate all the way through elims.
But what I'm saying here is it just makes the path look different, but there's still this magical path by which a less good debater can win your tournament through luck of the draw. You know, the problem we're facing is that right now there's the magic path to win, which is you get to flip neg every single round all through the elims. And only one kid in theory could do this. And that kid has an advantage and is blessed with an easier path to win the tournament than otherwise, and along the way could defeat students who are, in theory, by some mythical objective standard, better debaters than that kid.
Right.
This would do is only does is it changes the shape of that path. It doesn't eliminate it.
No, it doesn't.
And our goal, I think, is to eliminate it.
So many other moving factors would have to come into place, including taking into consideration the draw of the person they're also debating that is not taken into consideration with the coin flip. If we assume that every single debate round is random, right, and there's a 50-50 chance of winning the coin flip and a 50-50 chance of winning winning the debate round, then the path that for it to line up perfectly in the most optimal way for a given person, for the coin flip, there's a 50-50 chance that that happens. Winning is a 25% chance when you multiply it by winning the coin flip.
But that's not really true in bracket round.
But for based just on coin flip, it's that's what the percentage is. You have to do that twice for everything to line up perfectly on the other side of the bracket too, because remember, the side that you're going to get assigned is determined not only by you and how you have done, but also what your opponent has done previously as well. So the randomness level is less because you have to take into consideration the factors of both things happening to an optimal degree than just the coin flip being optimal.
But what I'm saying, though, is that if you take the top half of the bracket, like say you have a double octo, right, and you end up with eight kids who are seeded 1 through 8, those kids are very likely to win their double octos. You know, they're much more likely than any of the other kids in the bracket. The kids, half of those, presumably, will be AF. Those four kids will have an advantage over the other four kids going forward because they'll have an AF in the bank, and that when they later are in quarters and semis and whatever, debating students who are much closer to them in ability than a 2-31 debate, they'll have that negative opportunity in the bank, and therefore they will have, through no merit and no skill, gained an edge. Now, whether or not that edge manifests itself is...
I don't know if that's necessarily true. I think, in the next round, if they went AF, they have to go
Nay. Well, then two of them will have gone F.
Yeah, right? And so I mean, well, I don't. No, it's not a perfect system, but it's a better system.
And the F hits another the kid who just went F hits another F, and so you know they get to go F. Yeah,
Then we're just as it goes on, the likelihood of things working out in a way where. Oh, go ahead.
Well, the thing of it is this breaks down more at better tournaments. And that's been the experience of APTA. They don't worry too much about it at their normal tournaments, but at Nationals, it's a pronounced effect. And the reason why is the strength of those kids at the top is such that any advantage can be magnified in the elimination rounds to produce a problem. And I think that's also why we see the negative bias manifest itself more at stronger tournaments, because the distance between the best and the 50th, or the 15th rather, is lesser. So anything that really tilts the scale is more likely to manifest itself. So if there is unfairness embedded in the system, we're going to see the unfairness tend to emerge at TOCs or Octo's Bid tournaments. You know what I mean? And so, I mean, fundamentally, I think that it's a nice idea, but it still has an unfair pathway embedded in it. And so given that, I then ask again, why aren't we fixing the fundamental problem?
Well, obviously, but that... fixing that fundamental problem takes, well, for one, is not mutually exclusive to doing.
Right. Well, that's absolutely true. Yeah.
And I think, and once the fundamental problem is fixed, that is this negative, the negative bias, it will make the issue of having that coin flip even less. Necessary or less
actually relevant. In a way it would make it more relevant, right? Because then there'd be strategy behind picking the side other than
why should that strategy ever
I think that's a good reason not to have the coin flip anymore.
Yeah,
because then it becomes tricky whether or not you pick F or neg, right?
How did negs do in the TOC in the break rounds?
Well, we didn't have a final.
I don't know. It's I don't tough have a bracket. TOC just because it's such a small pool. It's like when they try to find trends in modern presidential elections. It's
right. Yeah.
So
But I'd just be curious to see how the negs did in the event. I mean, if the negs were predominant, were dominating or not. I don't know.
I don't know.
Now, purely subjectively, I can say that the eliminations I've watched, the negatives won, and usually won on stuff that was sort of like, I don't see how the AF could have won. There are several rounds of the TOC between evenly matched debaters where I'm just like, boy, you know, there's not really much the AF could have done in that situation. You know, and I think if you have a perfectly or nearly so executed affirmative and a perfectly or nearly so executed negative, the negative is going to win, you know.
That's bad.
Yeah. Yeah. And I saw it happen twice. There were two rounds that were very much like that. The AF did everything they could. The neg did everything they could. Negative ballot 3-0. So. So I don't know. I think I'm a little prickly about this too, because I view that if there are sort of, if we try putting tab window dressing over the problem, that delays a final solution to the actual problem. You know what I mean?
I don't know if it delays it or not.
Well, you know, people in debate are very kind. You know, we don't have a lot of mechanism for change, and it's really hard to get the community moving in the same direction. So I feel if we dick around with the tabbing, there'll be enough people who are like, well, let's just see how this works out. Delays the actual
maybe,
solution.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
The thing about the change is that on one hand, it's slow in the sense that to get there to be community norms. On the other hand, it can be changed so fast because every single tournament is its own autocracy. Like, they can just choose to do what they want, how they want to do it, and they can just say, we are going to adopt these new speech times, period. And you get some of the Octo's Bids tournaments to do it, and you know, it starts catching on a little bit, I think.
It's on you.
Change everything. Yeah.
I am planning on, by the way, next week, all the debate rounds that were recorded, I think I've got 8 or 9, maybe even 10 of them, from the Voices Round Robin, where we did the longer form where the affirmatives got where we did the alternate speech times. I've got a bunch of those rounds recorded on video. So I'm hoping to get those out.
That was a bit of an AFF bloodbath, right? That round robin?
Didn't
the AFFs always win or something? Could be a rumor.
I don't know if that's the case because a lot of affirmatives didn't know how to use the second affirmative constructive speech. But, you know, Chris Tice judged almost all those rounds. And the reason why I had him, or I shouldn't say I, that Tim and I had him judge a vast majority of them is because he sort of came up with the final speaking times for it based on what people were saying in our discussions on email about speech time. So he sort of he judged a lot of them, and so a lot of the recordings I think may also have his comments in them too. So
I'd be interested to see that.
I know that people did say that it helped the round become more focused because it tried to address two issues. That is, one, giving the affirmative a second constructive to make attacks on the negative case and make strategic choices that can be made prior to rebuttals. And two, what we wanted to do is force the negative to choose issues in their final rebuttal, as opposed to just being able to have an avalanche of things, and whatever the affirmative doesn't say, the negative can just pick, or the judge can just pick out of the negative speech to vote on.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that.
Negative choose happens to be like that. That is actually something that people thought, I believe, was more made the negative more difficult than the fact that the affirmative got another constructive. It was that they had to pick and choose issues and not just be able to go for everything, which they currently can do.
Yeah, I think
I would be interested to see.
In my mind, a very strong factor. Yeah.
Well, it's almost been an hour, and everybody was struck dumb by that.
How much of a critical mass do you think you'd need to push it? I mean, I'm sitting here at Yale, right, and that's my tournament for all intents and purposes. And you know, if I were to muck around with the LD times, I've got a lot of things to worry about at Yale. Yale has a strong national draw, but Yale also has a strong regional draw. Do I muck around with it and therefore lose half my entries? If I am the only one, do I lose all my entries?
That's the thing. You can't be the only. You have to have everybody say, "We're all going to do it." In a region,
Or at least enough people. And what number is enough? I mean,
serve on a committee for the National Forensic League to talk about like some LD issues. It's a little hazy at the moment exactly what that means and like what we're gonna do. I mean, I've served on similar committees before, but it would be interesting to. I'm sure speech time things are going to come up.
I think that the NFL is the last place.
Sure.
To because they have to get so much buy-in from so many different people, and
they've got a lot.
So strongly political.
But you have to have enormous buy-in. I don't want to train kids for two different formats.
I agree about that.
And so it has to be.
I think it sends an alarm signal to kids. I'm just going to say this from a recruitment standpoint. I'm going to say something controversial, a little controversial to perhaps end us off, okay? And I don't mean to be a negative Nancy about this.
Well, I won't end it off because I have a question, but go ahead.
Okay. All right. Well, I feel as a director of a very large team that it is very easy for me to sell policy to my kids, and it's very easy for me to sell PF to my kids, partially because there is such a clear contrast between those two events, right? I mean, it's very easy to explain the differences, and they appeal to different kinds of people. I think LD is in like a weird state right now where it is actually very difficult for me to sell it to kids. I discovered that this year. It used to be easy because I could say, well, one has a partner and the other doesn't, right? But you'll always get some minimum of kids because of that.
So if you hate people, you should do LD.
But seriously, I mean, I feel that LDers are aware that they're like the activity is in a weird state, and I almost feel like creating sub events with an LD is, I don't know how to sell that to my kids.
But there's sub events there. I mean, when policy started adding an additional minute to rebuttals, which is huge. I mean,
it is huge. I agree.
There was sub events. I mean, you went to some tournaments and it was four, and some tournaments.
I mean, I'm not necessarily, because I said from the beginning that I think that there's a lot of reasons that make sense to have a second constructed LD.
Policy is also done by probably about half as many schools as LD.
But even beyond
that, at that time.
I mean, at that time, everyone was doing policy. I understand that.
Right.
And I get all.
And now it's not. So I wonder if that's a problem. You know.
But I also think that there's a fundamentally tremendous difference between an extra minute on a speech and an additional speech. And I just think that that's something.
Yeah, that's a big difference.
We got to think about that. Not that, again, not that the idea is bad, but just what the, how it would be implemented, how we would sell it to kids, et cetera.
Well, there could be more incremental changes too. It's possible.
The fundamental, and this probably launches into a whole other discussion, but LD was created in trying to adopt the ideas of burdens from policy debate, with explicitly saying there aren't burdens that are in policy debate, and it was sort of a there wasn't consideration taken into what the words constructive and rebuttal actually mean. I mean, it's silly that you answer with new arguments in your first rebuttal speech as the affirmative. You have to make new arguments, but one of the fundamental rules about rebuttals is that you can't make new arguments. I mean, it just doesn't, it's a nonsensical, the terms we use to describe things, the quote unquote rules of debate, they don't make sense in Lincoln Douglas debates.
I agree about that.
And sure. That's the problem that needs, it has a, pure, it has an identity crisis born out of there not being anything that makes sense about what each speech should be doing, without necessarily saying you're going to have to break rules to do this speech, right. And so there is that has to be overcome for that to get fixed. Otherwise. We are continuing to try to build on sand, and it's as the debates become more sophisticated at its sooner level for debaters, and as they start mimicking the national circuit even more, it's going to become worse and worse and worse and worse, because there is not a coherent way to go back to how, quote unquote, how it was. When how it was falsely, was problematic from the
beginning. I just want to be very clear. I don't actually disagree with anything that you just said. And I think that this goes back to the same, this is actually in a way similar to the point I was trying to make about flipping sides and outrounds, that we sort of do things and accept things with very little thought being put into that, right? So similarly, I think you're right. I mean, I had, I've cited this example before because I think it's an illustrative example. My top policy debater the last 2 years, Andrew, debated LD twice at Scarsdale. And it was sort of interesting to watch a very experienced policy debater talk about what he found weird in LD. And actually the NC/1NR thing was to him the most perplexing thing of all. He said, I don't understand what this speech is, right? Because of the exact things that Beats is talking about. That there's a fundamental difference between what constructive is and what rebuttal is, and it is kind of weird that we have this speech that is a mishmash and whatnot, or a mashup, to use a 2010s term. It is weird, and I have a couple of old rostrums. I like kind of flipping through early things and seeing what the ideas were behind the event, but I kind of agree that with what Beats is saying, and I guess the sort of the implication or the underlying message of what Beats is saying, which is that, you know, LD was created to address what I think people saw were excesses in policy debate. And it is, I think, a very fair discussion to say if, you know, to reflect on what LD is now. And I understand all sides of that argument about excesses. But I think in attempting to address those excesses, perhaps certain things were not thought out in terms of like burdens and debate and whatnot, right? I mean, I think that that was probably what was happening, was that people were so concerned about the excesses that they were seeing that they maybe didn't think through the implications of what they were doing.
Well, the thing
is, it was like when PF thought that they could have a 1 minute speech.
God.
that within, I think, 2 years after the creation of it, people were like, there can't be a 1 minute speech. And so they changed it really quickly. Unfortunately,
it wasn't that quickly, unfortunately. It took about 8 years, actually. Yeah.
In LD, and this is just me not knowing history, but at least from what was ever changed by it, they didn't make quick changes if people were saying this is something that's a problem. And so it's just been built upon and built upon and built upon and built upon. But yeah.
Well, the trouble, I think, is that everybody was primed ahead of time with an image of what debate is based on policy. And I wonder if when they founded LD Debate, if there was, just like there was with PF, if there wasn't too much, you know, let's tweak around on the fundamental basis of what policy is and what we want it to be that policy isn't, and not enough sort of thinking through from the beginning. If you're going to have value debate, what does it mean and how do you go from there? And so there's a lot of action and reaction that's basically falls back to a policy background, and it doesn't always make a lot of sense. I mean, I've always said that I feel the strong difference between LD and a value debate and a policy debate is that in a value debate, it's fundamentally descriptive, not prescriptive. You know, in policy, you're saying you must do this thing that I am telling you you should do, and it's there's a bound action that needs to be done or not done. Whereas when you're talking about the value of something or the moral of something, you are talking about whether or not something is in the world. You know, it is, and to my mind, that means there's no particular burden at all, one way or the other. And, you know, the negative is as much a negative or a positive as the affirmative is, because you're describing the world rather than trying to change it. And absent a burden, then a lot of things fall away. There's no necessary reason for the affirmative to speak last.
Exactly.
You know, there's no necessary reason for there to be a plan. Or, you know, plans are good because they can be an example, but they're not something you're beholden to necessarily. You know, there's a lot of things that we assume to be true, and I think it really comes from where policy landed and not really where our debate form needs to be.
Totally agree. And that, and to me, it would be cool if our debate could be fluid enough that debaters would be able to debate everything from and this is how it used to be, where you could debate where if your criterion was utilitarianism, you could debate, you know, real life pros and cons of things or whatever, right? Like, that's not truly what that means, but people could debate back and forth whether moral issues or practical issues or policy issues. And it would be cool to me if LD became sort of that, a good hybrid where the debates, where it didn't matter whether or not the proposition was one of morality or a proposition of policy, people could be able to evaluate both using both sorts of standards.
Well, and it's a diversity of standards that I think makes LD interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, policy all comes down to a race to the largest body count, and there's really only one way to weigh a lot of policy rounds, and they don't have this diversity of methods of looking at things, whereas I think the fundamental lesson LD can teach kids is how do you look at the world? How do you make decisions? Mm-hmm. Not what the decision should be.
Agreed. That's why I hope to be able to introduce and have there be a form that is its own and is not taken from another style of debate, or it was not, that we're not still living in the shadow of being what policy isn't, and instead could be our own event, that I think changing the times is fundamental to that.
It's a good start. Yeah, definitely.
taking advantage of another pause.
That's a good place to end.
It is a great place to end, yes.
For next time. So good.
Okay, excellent. Okay.
Well, good night. Happy birthday to Star Wars.
Oh, gosh.
That's right. It is Star Wars' birthday today. And isn't that just... I was there when it was born.
Are we done?
Oh, let me turn it off.